You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is in no way affiliated with James Bond, Eon or the Fleming Estate. We've researched each episode as extensively as we can, but our information does come from a range of sources. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we can get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
You are listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast. I am Tom Butler. Joining me again, as always, is Brendan Duffy and Tom Wheatley.
Say hello.
Hello.
And it's another action-packed episode for you. And we are continuing our adventures into the letter C, C for Charlie. And yeah, there's a lot of is it correct to call them Bond girls or not? I feel bad calling it Bond girls.
I try not to call them Bond girls now because
yeah, it's old hat. Isn't
but I do find it hard to not say it. So sometimes I'll instantly say it without thinking about it, but I try not to.
Yeah. So we have a lot of Bond women, leading ladies, Bond's leading ladies. We've got a lot of those in today's episode, and also a Bond villain. It's really exciting. I feel like it might be the first Bond villain we've done.
Apart from Blofeld.
Oh, apart from Blofeld.
Forgot that one. That 2 hours of talking about him.
2 hours of talking about Blofeld, yeah, of course. And then also a couple of production people as well. So shall we kick off, Brendan? Who have you got?
C is for Karoff, Joseph Karoff. He's a designer born in New York in 1921 and he is apparently still active. Now, I've had an issue with this in terms of finding out about him. So, in terms of what he did for the Bond franchise, he created the logo, the 007 logo, with the gun as the number 7. It's iconic. We've all seen it. We all know it. All over the world. So, you would think there would be a plethora of information about this guy. It's been very difficult. So if anyone can add to this, please do. Please let us know. We'll give you the details at the end of the episode. So he's a major designer of book covers and movie posters. And his most famous work is obviously the Bond logo. And it was only meant to be a letterhead. So just for the production, when they were sending out invoices and stuff like that, it was just going to be at the top. And so he just was writing the number down and it sprang into his head. And he said, adding the barrel and the trigger was a pure joy. Now, I can imagine, it's hard for us because we've seen it. It's iconic. It's like, it seems obvious, doesn't it? You look at it, you go, 7. Yeah, it's the part of a gun. But you imagine at the time where you've been given that to design, it's pretty incredible to have that sort of light bulb moment.
Yeah.
So David Chasman, who was an executive for United Artists, he said, with Bond, it was obviously glamour, exotic locations, beautiful women. And we got artists like Robert McGuinness, Frank McCarthy, Bob Peaks and Mitchell Hooks. So these guys helped create those early posters that we all know, like from Russia with Love and Dr. No.
Iconic posters.
Yeah. We had advertising agencies come up with ideas, producers had ideas. I'd come up with concepts and so on. So it's impossible to credit any single advert to a single person because it became a group effort, a group idea, with one exception. The 007 pistol design was entirely the work of designer Joe Karoff. So he, and that's the thing that's stood the test of time, the thing they're still using now. And if you compare his original version to the one now, there's not that much difference, really. They've slightly modernized it. They incorporate, if it's got like two letter O's in the title, they'll incorporate that into the logo as well. But that 7 is still the handle of the pistol. So in terms of his other work, do you remember the Orion graphics at the beginning of films? You
know, oh, yes.
Yeah. So he designed that as well.
Oh, interesting. Nice.
West Side Story poster, again, incredibly famous.
Yeah,
I think most people could draw that from memory, just if you, even if you've not seen the film.
Don't think I could, but...
Okay, maybe you can.
I trust you.
The film poster for Manhattan.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And Cabaret. Ah.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Quite a selection.
Quite often his work, I mean, there's many, many more, but I didn't want to go, he's done so much that to go into it. But I also didn't, I couldn't sort of attribute it directly to him as well because the lack of information. So I only got the ones that definitely I know he did. And sometimes he gets confused with the work of Saul Bass.
Mm.
So they'll say it was his work and not Joe Karoff's, which is a shame. Mm. I think it's because their styles are very similar.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the information on Joe Karoff. So,
and he's what, 100 now?
He'll be 100 this year, yeah. Born in 1921.
I mean, that logo has really stood the test of time, hasn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it's such a simple one. I was actually thinking about that logo, and I've seen some of the older versions of it. And we look at it now and think, that's a cool logo, but it's actually... The concept is quite tacky, really, isn't it? The 007 and it's a gun. To do it well is quite an impressive feat. I reckon if that logo didn't exist and somebody said to one of us, I want you to draw a logo for 007 and turn the 7 into a gun, it would look awful.
Mm.
It'd be absolute rubbish. So yeah, it's a testament to the kind of font and the typography that's been used.
And it's good that they're not doing too much to stray away from it as well. I think it's because it's so iconic, isn't it? I mean, you can't. If you were to redesign that.
Yeah. Well, do many film characters have a logo themselves? They don't really, do they?
No, they all have typefaces. Like the Star, obviously Star Wars has its look, right?
And yeah,
I was going to say Star Trek to a certain extent, much less though.
Harry Potter, they all have a type, yeah.
That's right, yeah. But the name James Bond, that's the character. 007's actually not a character, is it?
It just becomes the branding, doesn't it? Yeah, Something's always bothered me about that 007 logo, though, is that it doesn't look like a Walther PPK, does it?
Oh, he's always got to pick something, hasn't he?
Oh, back to the drawing board, then.
Well, he's still alive. You can speak to him.
You've got to fudge it a little bit to make the 007 work. That's just my observation. It looks more like a Luger to me than a Walther PPK. But
I'll be honest, I've never thought about the type of gun it was.
Well, listen, that's how much detail I think about it.
C is for cartilage, William Cartilage.
And who's William Cartilage?
Well, he's a English film and television producer who's worked on You're In It Twice, Spy Who Loved Me, and Moonraker, as well as quite a few other films. To be honest, he's obviously an English filmmaker, and he was born in 1942, so he's been around for a while. He's got a few decades of films behind him. The most important thing you need to know about Cartilage is that he works quite a lot with Lewis Gilbert, who, of course, directed those three Bond films. So there's quite a big link. And it's not just Bond films. He works on a lot of films with Lewis Gilbert. So, it all kind of ties together when you realise that there's that relationship between the two and they kind of always work together.
What does he do?
Well, his roles on films have developed over time. So he's worked as kind of second unit assistant director on films. He's worked as associate producers. He's even worked as director on some films. So he's got quite a wide range of what he's actually worked on. But let me give you a bit of a history behind him, and we'll work towards the Bond side of things. So he's got quite a extensive series of films that he's worked on, and they do range quite a lot in terms of quality and what you might know. And one of the things that I found in an interview that he talked about is how he talks about the British film industry, and he talks a bit about how hundreds of British films are made, but hardly any of them people ever see. That's pretty true for a lot of the films that he's worked on. I don't know if they were popular at the time, but they definitely not stood the test of time. Mm-hmm. So ones that you will know about, or not just films, he associate produced three episodes of The Benny Hill Show. He worked with a second unit assistant director with Gilbert on Alfie, the original one. Co-produced Educating Rita. And then he worked with, and this ties in nicely with Jonathan Pryce, who we'll be talking about in a bit. He produced Consuming Passions, which is... have you heard of this film? This is a good example of what... A lot of his films are like this. You look at them, you think, never heard of that. It looks like a little B-rate movie that I never made it to the cinema or anything. But that was a pretty big film. It was written by Michael Palin and Terry Jones. Starred Jonathan Pryce. It looked massive. There's some big stars in it. And it's about... The concept is... quite ridiculous, but it's about a chocolate factory, and some bloke falls in the chocolate and dies, and they try to get the chocolate back, but they realize that everyone who's bought it loves it. It's like their favorite chocolate they've ever had, so then now they try and find a load of dead bodies to start making chocolate with. Quite an interesting concept. It actually, when I first read the synopsis, I had to read a couple more just to make sure I got it right, because it's such a difficult one to understand. He also wrote and directed An Ideal Husband in 1998, the Oscar Wilde play, which actually came out a year before another film of An Ideal Husband, which starred Rupert Everett. He didn't do the one with Rupert Everett, and he did the other one. And another thing that he's done is, and I'm just trying to remember this, and I'm sure I must have seen it, but he actually was nominated for an Emmy for Dinotopia.
Oh, it rings a bell.
I thought it might review, because you like your dinosaurs, don't you?
So, I do like a dinosaur, yeah.
but I couldn't remember what it was. And I tried to kind of watch a few clips, and I don't think I have seen it. I think I remember it existing, but I don't think I ever watched it. But yes, so that's all the kind of stuff he's done outside of Bond. But then obviously he's worked on You Only Live Twice, Spy Who Loved Me, and Moonraker. He was assistant director on You Only Live Twice, and then was associate producer on Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker. And they were the only three that he did. And to be honest, there's not a lot of information really about his kind of work on Bond. But some of the stuff that I did find out that was quite interesting was, as assistant director, one of his main jobs was to ensure that everything was basically working on set, and all the production schedules came together. But then when it came to Spy Who Loved Me, he started working with Ken Adam quite a lot, and he was quite heavily involved with the sets and the building of the sound stages, which of course in Spy Who Loved Me is a pretty big deal. We all know the story.
Massive
about
job, yeah.
The 007 stage, the biggest sound stage in Europe, being built and not being ready, so they had to do a lot of filming in different places as they're actually building this stage. And he talks quite a bit about how the strategy behind that and how he actually pulled all that together. And they said that because the stage was being built, and because that whole soundstage was, there was other companies trying to use it as well, that they had to have like this smart strategy to actually doing it. So what they did was they filmed all of the small stuff first. So all of the little office scenes, all of the ski lodge at the start where Roger Moore's has got his little watch, and then he shoots down the mountain and flies off with a big parachute. So General Gorgol's office and a few other things like that. So they filmed all the small stuff, and then once they'd done the small stuff, they went abroad and they did all the all of the sets in places, Egypt and Sardinia, and then they came back, and the only bits they had to do when the soundstage was ready and there was nobody using it, they filmed the supertanker scene and they did the Atlantis scenes then. So he was instrumental in all of this kind of process of putting all that together. And at that time, there was he talks a bit about this in a few interviews where he talks about how Spy Love Me was a massive budget. It was almost like there was a lull in Bond where the quality went down a bit and the size of the sets and everything went down a bit. And then Spy Love Me, they went big, they went all in, and they wanted to make it really good. And that's why they did all these massive sets. And they also there was a bit which I'll probably talk about this a bit more when we go through the Spy Love Me and Roger, but one of the things he talks about is that there was a big focus on Roger's character as well. And they wanted to make him his own character. In the previous two films, he's almost kind of trying to live in the shadow of Connery. And then in Spy Love Me, they wrote it for him so that it was about it. Roger's character was the focus. And as I think you'll agree, it comes across quite well. Good decision. So that's him, really. He was instrumental in a lot of the big scenes. In You Only Live Twice, he talks about they used to have script conferences where they'd have these ridiculous, outrageous ideas for things to happen in the film. And one of those was the helicopter picking up the car as they're driving off. And he was part of that process. So, yeah, a lot of big ideas. And then obviously did Moonraker and that was it. But one thing he did say about Moonraker, which I thought was quite interesting, is... although it was very successful, I always felt slightly uncomfortable that we were following a trend rather than setting one. The big thing about Moonraker was going up into space, which was because of Star Wars and all the other films at the time. So that's nice, knowing that he wasn't on board with that whole process and he saw that there was possible issues with it. But yeah, there you go. That's William Cartledge.
That's easy for them to say in hindsight, isn't it, about Moonraker?
Yeah, but I imagine at the time, if you were a scriptwriter on it and people kept saying, we've got to do space, we've got to do space, because it's big at the time, you'd be like, all right, but it's not really, it wasn't part of the original concept. And little bits like, because obviously he's working on it day to day, he's working on all these sets and stuff, so he would have been involved in the stupid, what was it, when he touches the keypad.
Yeah.
Things like that.
And it's Close Encounters, yeah.
Close Encounters. Things like that, you're probably involved in it going, do we have to?
I don't know. It feels like a natural progression for those films at that time. I could be wrong, but...
So there we go. That's William Cartledge.
C is for Carver, Elliot Carver. Elliot Carver, of course, is the primary villain in the 1997 James Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies, and he's played by the actor Jonathan Pryce. Carver has no provenance in the Ian Fleming novels. He's a completely original creation for the film, for the films. And as you'll remember, he's a media mogul whose news empire, the Carver Media Group, has the power to make or break governments by influencing public opinion. He's quite an interesting sort of complex villain. Bond says in the film, Carver can topple governments with a single broadcast. So I'll just give you a brief summary of his fictional biography, and then we'll talk a little bit about Jonathan Pryce and also where the character came from. So Elliot Carver in the story of the film was born in Hong Kong and is the illegitimate son of a German woman who dies in childbirth, and his father was the press tycoon Lord Roverman. His father sold him to a Chinese family for £50. And then at the age of 16, Carver went to work for a Hong Kong newspaper. And then by the time he turned 30, Carver takes revenge on his father by building a rival chain of newspapers that drives his father to bankruptcy and then to suicide. So then when we meet him in Tomorrow Never Dies, he's in his 50s and he sees himself as the Emperor of the Air, a modern day Napoleon who commands papers and news stations like a general commands his army. And then obviously there's that famous scene where he's blackmailing the president with a cheerleader tape, and then leaks that to the press. So he sort of proposes as a freedom-loving philanthropist, but actually, you know, his plan is to create a war between Britain and China so that he can install a government in China that will give for his media group satellite transmission rights. It's quite a complicated setup, but he's a bad guy, basically. He's got this stealth plane, and he kicks off the events of Tomorrow Never Dies by shooting down a Chinese plane and sinking the HMS Devonshire. And stealing a missile from the ship as well. And then James Bond obviously is then sent in to investigate, as is Wai Lin of the Chinese military. And obviously the interesting connection between Carver and Bond is that Bond had a past relationship with Carver's wife, Paris, who we'll talk about in a minute. As you know, Carver dies at the end of Tomorrow Never Dies. Spoiler, he gets killed with a CVAC drill. And then in the press, it's reported that he killed himself on his yacht in the South China Sea. So he's played by Jonathan Pryce. You guys know Jonathan Pryce?
Mm-hmm. Very well, yes.
What a great actor. He's one of my favourite actors, but I think he's horribly miscast in this role.
Agreed, yeah.
Yes.
Because the one thing we know about Jonathan Pryce is he's a very charming, almost avuncular screen presence, right? Mm. He's just not... Yeah. For me, anyway, I just don't think I don't think he's the right man for this role. But he does a good job. So he's born in 1947, in June 1947. He's got a CBE, and he was born in Wales. He's actually Welsh, which I didn't know before I started researching him. He went to grammar school, and then at age 16, he went to art college, and then he went off to train to be a teacher in Lancashire. And actually, while he was studying to be a teacher, he took part in a college theatre production. And actually, he impressed his tutor so much that they suggested he should become an actor and actually applied on his behalf to join RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, which is like, you know, the pinnacle of British acting education. Yeah. And he was awarded a scholarship to join RADA. So he was actually born John Pryce with an I, and he had to change his name to Jonathan Pryce because of equity. There was another actor with a similar name. He joined the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool when he graduated and became an artistic director. And then he performed with the Royal Shakespeare Company and at the Nottingham Playhouse. And then in 1977, he won his a Tony Award for a play that he did with Mike Nichols. This was called The Comedians. Sorry, just called Comedians. And it was a role written specifically for Jonathan Pryce. And then it was around that time he made his first film appearance in the film called The Voyage of the Damned, starring Faye Dunaway. Then he had a load of success on the stage again, continuing doing that. And then he had his big film breakthrough in 1985 in Terry Gilliam's film Brazil, which... for me, it is a masterpiece, a science fiction masterpiece. Definitely seek that out. He worked again with Gilliam on Baron Munchausen. Again, one of my favourite films of Gilliam's.
I forgot he was in Baron Munchausen. Who was he in it?
Yeah, he plays the right ordinary Horatio Jackson, which suggests he's a sailor. But I don't remember him that well either. But interestingly, which I learned while researching him, in 1988, he also appeared in three of the earliest episodes of the improv show Whose Line Is It Anyway? He was one of the founder cast members of Whose Line Is It Anyway? Alongside Paul Merton and John Sessions.
Brendan's suddenly interested.
Wow, I didn't know this.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. It was around this time he then got into a bit of trouble because he was in a play called... he was in Miss Saigon, the musical, and he was playing a role of the engineer. Apparently he's the first person to play this role, and it's written down as a Eurasian pimp. I don't know what that means, but apparently he was playing a Eurasian pimp, and it meant that he was playing an Asian role, but obviously he's a white English actor, a Welsh actor. And so there was a lot of... it was fine. I think it was fine in the West End, but when it moved to Broadway, there was a lot of protesting against the play, and particularly actually against Pryce himself. And actually, Cameron McIntosh, the producer, had to cancel the production in New York. After it was announced that it was cancelled, there was a lot of protest then, counter protest from the acting union. And they ended up putting the production on. And actually, Jonathan Pryce won a Tony Award in 1995 for that.
Oh, he kept the same role.
Yeah, he did it. Wow. And actually, Charlton Heston, this is Jonathan Pryce, he said, "I got support from very strange and unwanted quarters. Charlton Heston sent me a photo of him playing Fu Manchu, and he signed it from one yellow face to another. And I thought, that's not what I'm doing, Charlton. Thanks for your support anyway." And actually, he was very sympathetic to the people he had issues with the with playing the role as well. But there you go. Mm. But I mean, you know, we could talk about his career for forever. I mean, he's made so many amazing films and TV shows. Evita in 1996. He was in the Pirates of the Caribbean films. He was in Glengarry. Yeah, he was in Glengarry Glen Ross, The Age of Innocence, Terrence Malick's The New World. A brilliant film called The Wife from 2017. I don't know if you've seen that with Glenn Close.
I can see the DVD cover. I think I've got it somewhere. I've watched it.
It's fantastic. And then in 2019, he was Oscar nominated for playing Pope Francis in The Two Popes.
Oh, yeah, I really like that film.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Fantastic. Yeah. He's great in that.
Yeah.
Obviously, we also know him as the High Sparrow in Game of Thrones. He was in Taboo with Tom Hardy. And then he's going to be playing Prince Philip in The Crown also.
Ooh. Of course, yes.
Yeah, in the final seasons of The Crown. So that's going to be great. Looking forward to that. So let's talk about Elliot Carver and Jonathan Pryce. So Bruce Feirstein, who we know was working on GoldenEye and then went on to work on Tomorrow Never Dies, he said, "I wanted Elliot Carver in Tomorrow Never Dies to be a larger-than-life villain. He's someone who can do anything that is possible to do today with an unlimited amount of money." He said, I was in my hotel room flipping channels one morning between two different news networks watching their coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and getting two very different takes on the same story, and it stuck with me. At that moment, I thought the villain could be in the media, and that's where the idea came from.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, Feirstein actually was able to pitch this idea to Cubby before Cubby died in 1997. 96, 97.
Because as we know, they work on the next film as they're doing the current film.
So it would have been the last one that Cubby would have had direct knowledge of, and he actually really liked the idea. And then Michael G. Wilson liked the idea as well. And actually, when you think about it, the press was a really hot topic at the time because, you know, Diana was being hounded by the press. Rupert Murdoch was, you know, everyone was talking about Rupert Murdoch. Robert Maxwell had killed himself in 1991. He was the owner of the Mirror Group. And so the press was such a like hot topic at the time. And as we know, the Bond films really, really go for these hot topics. So Feirstein's idea for Carver was that he was going to start a war over Hong Kong as part of a plot of personal revenge. And the character was initially going to be called Elliot Harmsway. Now, this is a name that is connected with Fleming because Fleming's wife, Anne, had previously been married to a press magnate called Esmond Cecil Harmsworth, who was the second Viscount of Rothermere and publisher of the Daily Mail. So the name Harmsway, Harmsworth, but the producer decided it was too close for comfort, and so the name was changed to Elliot Carver. Feirstein said that Albert Finney was the physical prototype for Carver. Obviously, we know Albert Finney went on to play Kincaid in Skyfall, but this was his first brush with Bond. And
it's
actually
interesting. It probably would have been better, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, listen to who they offered it to. Anthony Hopkins. They actually offered it to Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
Mm. And he was very keen to do it, but actually decided not to do it because he went on to star in Martin Campbell's Mask of Zorro instead.
Oh, dear.
Anthony Hopkins. You know, this is the 90s. This is Anthony Hopkins at his absolute prime. And, you know, if this had been Elliot Carver, Anthony Hopkins, you know, it would have been very different. But Barbara Broccoli was a fan of Price, and he said that he decided to do it because my children absolutely adored GoldenEye. And their response to that probably had a lot to do with me accepting the role. So there you go. So he says in an interview with AV Club, he said, "I think it comes as a surprise to a lot of people when I say to them, well, I never really was a big James Bond fan. I enjoyed them, but I didn't go out of my way to seek them out. So at the time, it had never been an ambition of mine to play a Bond villain until my agent, James Sharkey, who was at the time Tim Dalton's agent, I think it had been an ambition of Jimmy's that I should be a villain. But it was a very happy, fortuitous kind of thing that particular script and that particular character I could relate to." So I think he liked the idea of Carver being this complex villain. He thought it was an idea that he could get his teeth into. And he really practiced for this big, long speech that he was supposed to give in the film. The one where he's thought to be addressing the world audience, talking about, you know, his vision for tomorrow, his newspaper. And so he practiced this speech, and actually where he delivers the speech, but in the film it cuts away to James Bond having a fight. Do you remember he has this fight backstage after Carver's men take him out of the party? So he's giving this speech, Jonathan Pryce is giving it him all, but actually the film's showing something completely different. So Jonathan Pryce just says, "Ah, Hollywood, I enjoyed it, but the production people, the Broccolis, are good people, so it was nice to do. And I enjoyed being with Pierce Brosnan. He's a good guy." Brosnan, for his take, he said that Jonathan Pryce is stellar. He's a wonderful actor. We have a really flamboyant, maniacal, charismatic villain. And the greater the villain, the greater the hero. But actually, as we know, as we've discussed before, this film was a bit of a mess behind the scenes. The scenes were being constantly rewritten. And actually, Jonathan Pryce said, you know, he found it really challenging. He's quoted as saying, "I will make sure in the future that it's written into the contract that the script I agree to will be the script we use." And he later told the writer Gary Morecambe in the book Martini's Guns and Girls that he'd wished that director Roger Spottiswoode had allowed him to camp it up a little bit more. So that's Elliot Carver.
Interesting. So I mean, a bit of a divisive villain. I think, you know, as you're saying, with Tomorrow Never Dies, Elliot Carver is just Tomorrow Never Dies all over, isn't he? Everything about that film is just big, brash, over the top.
It just
looks good, though, doesn't it? It is generally quite an interesting villain. As you say, I think it's just too complicated. He's just too much to him. It's very difficult to follow what he wants. Because when a man's... What I always think about Elliot Carver is that when a man is like that, like desperate to, you know, power and money, the way he's going about it seems so roundabout. Like, he's got all this money at his disposal. He's got stealth boats. He's using the newspapers to then start a war between other people when he could probably just do it a lot simpler.
Yeah,
he's probably peak complex villain, isn't he, for Bond? And he's got too complex.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's definitely a disconnect between the idea and the execution. I think the idea is sound. I like the idea, but there's just something just doesn't match up. And I love Jonathan Pryce, but just for me, the two things just don't meet in the middle.
No, I think there's also a problem with Tomorrow Never Dies in that it doesn't age well for a lot of reasons, but especially his plot doesn't age well because it is so specific to that time and what was happening in the media at that time. Because now you look back and you go, was that? I imagine people who watch it who are young, and were like kids at that time, and now they're adults, looking back, going, "What is it? What's it going on about?
What's a newspaper?
What's a newspaper?
And just the idea. You can imagine the newspapers wield so much power as well, which is not the case anymore, is it?
Well, it's tantamount to them doing it nowadays, but with social media. And then it's just too complicated, isn't it? Just rob a bank, sort of load of gold bullion from Fort Knox, please. Nice and simple.
Just world domination.
Yeah.
But Elliot Carver, obviously famously married to Paris Carver.
Yes.
Here we go.
So C is for Carver, Paris Carver, who's the wife of Elliot Carver, but also the former lover of James Bond. So when in the film, when they first meet again, Bond and Paris Carver meet, and he gets a slap, a nice hard slap. That's the first thing that happens, because she's angry that the last time they saw each other, he just said, "I'll be right back." And obviously he wasn't, he scarpered. So you can tell by the way that they speak, you know, and talk to each other, the body language, they know each other very well. She also says, "You still keep a gun under your pillow." Elliot Carver is jealous of this because he's not stupid. He can see that that's the case. So she has to make up a lie. She goes to Bond's hotel room and says that, you know, she still clearly has feelings for him. And said that she would check and if he's died and things like that. He confesses. So this is, they're trying to make Bond a bit deeper. He confesses that they were getting too close. It was getting too serious. And so he backed out. They spend an evening together. Classic Brosnan. So, and she's actually a key to helping Bond locate Carver's secret lab. Carver learns of this. Sends Dr. Kaufman, who is a hitman, to go and assassinate her. And then Bond returns to find Paris dead. So, relatively short but pivotal role in the plot. So Terry Hatcher said, "It's a small role, but it motivates James's actions in a way. I guess it's one of the few times in a Bond film that there has been some sort of past emotional relationship between Bond and a woman. She has to make a choice to be loyal to her cruel and unscrupulous husband or help her former lover. And this decision is an integral part of the movie." And it is, because it speeds up him locating Carver. Who knows how long it would have taken without that. So in terms of the role, so she got the role over Monica Bellucci, who obviously went on to become a Bond girl anyway. And at the time of shooting, she was 3 months pregnant at the filming start with her husband, John Tenney. And the publicist said the pregnancy did not affect the production schedule. However, Pierce Brosnan and Terry Hatcher didn't get along. There was a misunderstanding on Brosnan's sort of part. He didn't know. For some reason, they didn't let him know that she was pregnant, which, would have surely created a bit of understanding from him. So he says, "She was late to the set because she was newly pregnant. I got very upset with her. She was always keeping me waiting for hours. I must admit, I let slip a few words which weren't very nice. No one told me her situation until afterwards."
Well, I guess at 3 months, though, you're at that 12-week threshold, aren't you? I mean, you're not really supposed to tell
people. I know, but you're
making
it a Bond film.
True.
I think that overrides it, you know. At least something. Give Brosnan... So, keeping him waiting for hours, that's no good, is it?
I suppose if it's affecting stuff a lot, if you wouldn't necessarily tell them if it wasn't an issue, but if you were late all the time and it was causing problems, you might have to...
You go, right, this is why. And according to anecdotes from the crew, that slapping scene didn't require much acting.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. So Terry Lynn Hatcher was born December the 8th, 1964, in California. She studied acting at the American Conservatory Theatre. One of her early jobs in 1984, she was a NFL cheerleader for the San Francisco 49ers. So something that comes up when you have a look for is her performance in Seinfeld episode.
I was about to say Seinfeld, yeah.
Yes. So in 1993, she plays a character called Sidra, who breaks up with Jerry because Jerry gets...
an idiot.
Because Jerry's an idiot. Yeah, Jerry gets Elaine to go to a sauna to try and work out if her breasts are real or enhanced. And so obviously she finds this out and then breaks up and has that parting shot at the end of the episode, which was only in the script as "and by the way, they're real." Terry Hatcher actually ad-libbed the "and they're spectacular," which is that's the iconic line, isn't it? She also returned for two further episodes, the pilot in the fourth season finale and the finale in season 9.
Yeah, everyone's in the finale.
Yeah, they'll come back. She then went on to land a starring role in, and this is where I first sort of knew her, was Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman.
It was huge, Dean wasn't Kane. It?
Absolutely massive. Yeah. I remember watching it on Saturday mornings, live and kicking. It was... during Love and Kicking.
Yeah, it was huge. And in my back, I can remember the music, I can remember some scenes. Can't for the life remember me what happens in it. It goes on for ages, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Can't think of one storyline to it.
No, apart from they go flying a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
So that ran from 93 to 97. In 1995, I thought this was interesting, there was a picture of Terry Hatcher wrapped in a Superman cape. It became the most downloaded image with 20,000 downloads each month.
Wow.
that record lasted 6 months.
Amazing.
It seems nothing. That's like that would be seconds now, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Then she went on to play a lead role in Desperate Housewives, which ran from 2004 to 2012. I've not seen it. Have either of you ever
seen a couple
it?
Of them?
Well, there's 180 episodes, so
yeah.
8 seasons. So she actually won a Golden Globe for that in 2005. So that's taken up a large chunk of her career. In 2018, she won Star Baker on the Stand Up To Cancer Celebrity Bake Off.
What did she make?
I think there was muffins.
It was Muffin Week.
Yeah. You've really done your research.
I did glance at that because I thought, oh, you might ask. Yeah, she made some muffins. And then in 2018, she also debuted a YouTube food channel called Hatching Change. So she makes lots of different stuff. She's very into cooking. She does lots of different sorts of culinary stuff. Worth a look if you're into food and
teriyaki. You've told us enough with muffins. Yeah. You don't need to keep going on about
it. You're done.
I don't need any recipes, mate.
So yeah, that's Paris Carver, played by Terry Hatcher.
Something I really like about Paris Carver is that she is the first Bond girl with a history with Bond before the film starts.
Mm.
And that idea is sound. It's a great idea.
Yeah. Mm. But that's because Spottiswood said they wanted to create the first sort of Bond woman.
Yeah.
She said that, right? That was more well-rounded and had a bit of a backstory.
But again, it's just underused and the concept is not... Mm-hmm. It's not...
Well, you can see with that whole Bronson era, that's what they're trying to do. And we talked about Tomorrow Never Dies being like, yes, it's the first one that Barbara and Michael G. Wilson really started working on, but it was still under the, you know, Cubby's umbrella. Whereas you can see it developing, can't you? World's Not Enough. It goes one step further and you get a much more rounded female character. But I agree. It's a nice angle, isn't it? If it's just a pity, didn't quite work out in that film.
And also, I like the line about the sleeping with your gun under the pillow, because that sort of comes back in Die Another Day, doesn't it? Where he goes to bed and puts the gun under the pillow, which is a lovely bit of symmetry, I think.
Yeah.
That's today's reference of Die Another Day, ticked off.
Yeah.
And then just one last thing about Terry Hatcher. There was a rumour a couple of years ago that she was homeless. Did you remember this?
No.
And she had to go to the press because there was pictures of her living in a camper van, but it was just for some TV programme she was making where she was driving around in a camper van. But yeah, like National Enquirer had her on the front page saying she was homeless. But
she was getting paid $280,000 an episode on Desperate Housewives. She's not going to be homeless, is she?
That's Elliot Carver. He's having his last laugh, isn't he? He's putting the paper stories in the paper.
C is for Carver, Rosie Carver. So Rosie Carver is the character in Live and Let Die. She plays, she is the CIA agent who Bond meets on the island of San Monique. And we find out later on in the film that she's actually a double agent and she's working for Dr. Kananga. I know you've watched this one recently, Brendan.
Mm-hmm.
And her role is, I think she's quite, the concept is quite interesting of the character. She comes in as kind of a ditzy, a bit scared CIA agent and Rogers Bond is kind of protecting her and guiding her through. And then there's a few scenes where she's just plays this scared character where there's a dead snake, I think, drops out of a cupboard, and then there's a voodoo hat and she's shocked by those. So Bond is like the hero who makes her feel better. And eventually he finds out that she's the enemy. She runs off and she gets shot by the Kananga scarecrows. Do you remember those?
Yeah, the coconuts.
Scary things.
The coconuts.
They've got good... Sorry?
They're coconuts, aren't they?
Yeah, coconut scarecrow things. And they've got like weird guns in their mouths. Mm. How are they actually... I couldn't remember how they're actually operated. Do we ever find out?
No.
They're just...
No, the gun just comes out the mouth, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think when I was a kid, I always used to think there was somebody in them, but never worked out what was actually how they were operated. So anyway, that is Rosie Carver. She was played by Gloria Hendry, born on March 3rd, 1949. She was an actress and a model. She's done quite a lot of stuff. She was born in Jacksonville in Winter Haven, Florida. Apparently the sources differ, according to Wikipedia. She began a professional career as a Playboy model and worked at the New York Club for a few years until 1972. She received her first acting job in a fairly pretty impressive role to get for
your first action job. It was in Sidney Poitier's film For Love of Ivy, which I haven't seen, but I have heard about it being quite a good film. And she also was in a film called The Landlord in 1970. In the Bond series, she became the first African-American woman to become romantically involved with 007. She's not the first African-American Bond girl. That goes to Trina Parks, who, of course, plays Thumper in Diamonds Are Forever. And she's got she did loads of 1970s blaxploitation films. And I've never seen hardly any blaxploitation films, so I don't know any of these films. Slaughter's Big Ripoff, Black Caesar, Hell Up in Harlem, all these films that I don't know of. But yeah, she was in a lot of those. And yeah, so apart from those, she's not been in a lot of films that we probably know of. But talking about, she did a quite good interview, and I'm not sure if it was originally on CommanderBond.net, but that's where the interview is. And it's quite detailed. She talks quite a lot about her whole experience with the Bond series. One interesting thing, and obviously at the time, racism was a big factor in not only making the film, but just in general, all around the world. So there was a big kind of media coverage on that part of the film and the kind of censorship and all the stuff that happened around that time. But she talks quite interestingly, quite a big quote this one, but I thought it was quite interesting because it adds a bit more depth into Harry Saltzman. She says, I remember Harry Saltzman talking seriously to me about racism. He expressed that it was a shame that we still had racism. He said that everyone should marry another race, so no one could say they were one race or the other, and this would stamp out racism. Now it goes a bit weird. He suggested to me that I should marry a Caucasian. Then he introduced me to a very special gentleman whom he considered would be a good choice for me to marry. I went out with him a couple of times and he told me how to dress and act. I became disinterested in an arranged marriage. So that's quite an interesting answer to give to an interview. But yeah, and then later on she talks a little bit about her media attention, and she talks quite a bit about how when the film came out, and a lot of the interview that I read and some of the other surrounding bits I read really do focus on the kind of race side of the film world at that time. And she talked about media attention from the film, and she says that when the film came out, she was really popular and she was in all the papers and everything like that, and then it just kind of disappeared. She says that, "I found after time had passed my name was no longer associated with the film, nor was I named or called upon when there was mention or request of the 007 Bond ladies. I never knew what to think of that." Which is kind of true. You do. She's not one of the kind of historical Bond girls that you see cropping up all the time, is she? She's not in a lot of interviews or the kind of Bond documentaries and stuff that you see cropping up.
No.
Another thing she talks about as well was Roger Moore. Interestingly, in this interview, they talk about her relationship with Roger Moore. And in Bond's James Bond diary, which is obviously from the film Live and Let Die, he refers to her as Glory Ass. And they suggest that it's led some people to believe that the two didn't get on set. But she completely disputes that. And she says that they had a great relationship. She says, throughout the filming of Live and Let Die, Roger Moore and Harry Saltzman were most gracious and kind to me. During our stay in Jamaica, my hotel room was located in between Roger and his family and Harry and his family. And I had great pleasure of meeting and often having dinner with them. And she just felt that they wanted to keep an eye on her and keep her safe. So she stayed quite close to them. Yeah, and then the other area is there's a couple of other interesting areas about her as well, where she was, when they were talking about killing her off, she was called into a meeting, and she says, "I was called in for a meeting with Harry and Guy, who said, in essence, we don't want to kill you off because so many people like you. So stand by, there might be a script change." A couple of days after that, Harry apologised that they had to kill me. So that's an interesting turn of events.
Plot twist.
And then just lastly, apparently, and I've saw this on a few accounts, I don't know how true it is, but there was a role change for Solitaire. Apparently Solitaire was apparently meant to be the African-American actress, and then and vice versa. But she says, "One day someone on the set came up to me and told the story that the role of Solitaire was initially written for a black actress was hired to play the part. While filming somewhere in New York City or New Orleans, they decided that it was too risky to have a black woman end up with James Bond. Therefore, the role of Rosie Carver was switched to black and the role of Solitaire was switched to white." Which is quite an interesting state of affairs, and you can imagine how that film would be very different if you swap those around. But amazing that in those days that it just affected so many. You just had to completely change the script just to suit that what was going on in the world and people's viewpoints. And then just lastly, well, this is a very small lastly, and it's not very interesting, but Rosie was subsequently adapted for the James Bond 007 role-playing in Her Majesty's Secret Service tabletop role-playing game. So that's the last time that character appears in the Bond series. And I've never heard of this game, but we should get it one day, and we'll all come around my house and play the On Her Majesty's Service tabletop role-playing game.
I don't even know what that is. What is that? What does that mean?
Well, I don't know what it is.
What are those words you are saying? I don't understand.
Well, I'm assuming it's like some sort of Dungeons and Dragons right. Secret Service game where you sit around a table with cards.
Okay. I've actually come across this game.
It sounds right up your street, Brendan.
I've come across this game. It looks quite interesting.
Yeah?
Yeah. I've seen a few of these board games. They're quite complicated by the looks of it. So, yeah, come and stay over for 4 or 5 days and we'll really get to grips with it. So there we go. That's Rosie Carver, played by Gloria Hendry.
Yeah, and shout out to the 007 Diaries, the Roger Moore book from Live and Let Die. That is an absolute page-turner. It's a brilliant book, if you haven't read it.
Oh, I wish some of the other Bonds had done those.
Yeah, I wish he'd done more.
What, Roger?
Yeah.
I can't remember, what was the reason he did it? He talks about it at the start of the book and why he...
I think he thought he was going to do one for every film, but I think he only did it for this one. But it's fantastic. It's recently come back into print, and I picked up a copy, and it's well worth a copy. Well worth picking up.
I've been listening to it on the old audiobook version.
Did he record it?
No, I don't think he records that one. He's only done one of his books. I need to check. I don't think he has. But it's an interesting one. It's a little bit close to the nerve, a lot of it.
I mean, it's obviously of its time. It's of its time.
Yeah, so some of it's a bit difficult to read. But, yeah, no, it's really interesting to hear. Because obviously it was his first one as well. So I'd love to read that one. And then if he'd done one on View to a Kill, that would have been brilliant.
There we go. There's our View to a Kill mention. Tick.
So, yeah, there we go. Rosie Carver.
C is for Case. Tiffany Case. Tiffany Case, of course, is a jewel smuggler who gets mixed up with James Bond in the 1971 film Diamonds Are Forever, and she is played in the film by Jill St. John. She was, in fact, the very first ever American Bond girl. So a little bit about Jill. She was born Jill Arlen Oppenheim in LA in August 1940. And her mother changed Jill's last name to be more Hollywood sounding during her adolescence. So she changed her name from Jill Oppenheim to Jill St. John. She began acting at the age of 6 and made on radio, and then made her screen debut in 1949 at the age of 9 in A Christmas Carol, full length TV movie. She, in 1957, when she was 16, she was signed by Universal Pictures for a 7-year contract, and she made her major studio film debut with Summer Love. She then later signed a contract with 20th Century Fox, who also tried to build her into a star, and she was in a few films there, including The Lost World, which is obviously a second dinosaur movie mention of the week.
That's the theme of this episode.
Dinosaurs, yeah. Well, actually, I've got another theme coming up for you. See if you can spot it. St. John had a key role in a film, something called Come Blow Your Horn with Frank Sinatra, in which she received a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actress. And it was around this time she sort of really decided, rather than being a dramatic actress, she wanted to be a comic actress. She was then in a number of comedies. Who's Minding the Store with Jerry Lewis in 1963. Who's Been Sleeping in My Bed with Dean Martin in 1963. And then 1964's Honeymoon Hotel, which stars Robert Morse and Nancy Quam. Around this time, she started to guest star in television shows, including Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, Burke's Law. And she then was given her first female lead by MGM in 1965 with a spy spoof around the time of the spy boom, kickstarted by James Bond, in a film called The Liquidator, which, Wheatley, I think you've talked about before.
Yes.
Shirley Bassey.
John Barry did the soundtrack.
Shirley Bassey did the theme song.
That was it, yeah.
With Lalo Schifrin. And then she had a supporting role in a film in 1967 called How I Spent My Summer Vacation with Robert Wagner, who she later goes on to marry. Right. So, yeah, she did loads of TV stuff, and movies, so many different roles. She basically was super busy, super popular. And in 1971, that's when she gets the call for Diamonds Are Forever. So, talking about being in a James Bond film, Jill St. John said, "Who would not want to be in a Bond film? They're so exciting and so interesting. The special effects are fabulous and the women are always larger than life. And not to mention Sean Connery. You become part of the history of Bond. That's very flattering." So in 1971, it was reported by Variety that Raquel Welch was going to be the film's femme fatale. But that her playing a role in the film would hinge on who's playing James Bond. Because if you can remember at this time, George Lazenby was not returning to play James Bond. They didn't know who was going to play Bond. A number of different people were in the frame for it. Actually, Raquel Welch had been cast to play Domino in Thunderball, but she had to be released from that film to star in Fantastic Voyage. And actually, Diamonds Are Forever director Guy Hamilton thought Raquel Welch might overpower 007 on screen. He thought she was just too much. He told Cubby, "Bond and Raquel together is bad chemistry. She's just too much animal for this role, this particular role," which is a weird thing to say, I think. An actress called Linda Thorson met with Albert Broccoli, Cubby Broccoli, to be considered to play Tiffany Case. Do you know Linda Thorson?
No.
She was in the Avengers. She was in the last series of the Avengers with Patrick McNee.
But the new Avengers?
No, in the original Avengers, she was in the last series. So she succeeded Diana Rigg. So, yeah, but she never got it. She didn't get the part, apparently because her hair wasn't long enough. I don't know.
Oh, that's a bit unfair.
Yeah. So this is where Jill St. John's story starts to get really interesting. Okay, so there's a man called Sidney Korshak, and he is helping Cubby to set up deals in Vegas so they could shoot on the Strip. And we'll go into this in a lot more detail when we get to Diamonds Are Forever. But he basically suggested, you know, is there a role for Jill St. John? She might have been dating Korshak at the time. And so Korshak, as it transpires, was a lawyer and a fixer for basically people in power and also for the Chicago Mafia. And his reputation as the Chicago mob's man in LA made him one of Hollywood's most fabled and influential fixers. And he was named the most powerful lawyer in the world by the FBI. Mm. One of his clients actually was Jimmy Hoffa, who you may have seen in the recent film The Irishman. So quite an interesting character working with Cubby to get this film made. And when he obviously suggests, you know, casting his friend in the film, then they have to take it quite seriously. And at the time, Jill St. John was dating George Lazenby.
I did not know that.
George Lazenby was actually living with Jill St. John when he turned down the chance to appear in Diamonds Are Forever. Now, Jill St. John, how to put this politely, she had quite a lot of gentleman friends in the 60s, and fair play to her, she really had a high hit rate of the men she was dating. And this is a funny quote from her. She said, "The longest period of celibacy for Jill St. John is the shortest distance between two lovers, I suppose." She was just, you know, this was like the peak.
You said that? She said that.
This is the peak of sexual liberation.
Fair play to her.
Absolutely fair play to her. Here are some of the men that she dated: Michael Caine, Sean Connery, Robert Evans, Glenn Ford, David Frost, Henry Kissinger.
David Frost?
Yeah. Peter Lawford, George Lazenby, Tom Mankiewicz, Jack Nicholson, Roman Polanski, Tom Selleck, Frank Sinatra, Robert Vaughn, and
Tom Selleck?
And Adam West.
What? Adam West?
These are all men who've been...
What a lineup that is.
I know. I mean, Jill St. John,
and
you are
my... And it's not even like a core theme.
It's
not like, oh, she goes for the macho ones. She's eclectic.
Anyway, I'm a big fan. So Cubby agreed for her to play Plenty O'Toole, which is the other big role in... Other female role in Diamonds Are Forever. Guy Hamilton said, "Over my dead body." Because, And well, listen, this is his words, not mine. The role of Plenty O'Toole needs someone with enormous tits. So, apologies. That's his words, not ours.
Well, you do kind of need that with the name, don't you? That's kind of the point.
So, Guy Hamilton and Cubby apparently had their only ever fight over this situation. They had a huge row. It was the only row the two of them ever had. In the end, they both agreed it would be better for her to be Tiffany Case. And so they told Sidney Korshak, and then Jill St. John came round that night and they had a drink with her and decided she would take the role of Tiffany Case. Mm. So, if you remember, she meets Bond in Amsterdam and he's infiltrating the diamond smuggling pipeline. Bond is posing as Peter Franks, who he intercepts and kills. And then he tells Tiffany that the man he kills is 007.
Interesting fact. I've been in that lift.
Very good.
I've told you that before.
Is that in London or in Amsterdam?
It's in London. It's in Holborn.
Right. I read about
this. It's a media agency nowadays, or it was.
Yeah, I read about this. Yeah.
But I only realised when I was in the lift, I went, this lift? And then someone said, oh yeah, it was in a Bond film.
So they obviously travel then to LA, smuggling the diamonds that Bond has in Peter Franks' body, and then they're switched out by Bond. So when Plenty O'Toole gets killed by Winton Kidd, she then joins forces with Bond because she realises she's going to be the next one to get bumped off. She's kidnapped by Blofeld in drag, and then they travel to the oil rig together. And obviously then in the end, Bond and Tiffany go off on a cruise and they're attacked by Winton Kidd one last time.
Yeah.
So we don't learn much about Tiffany's background in the film other than that she was born on the floor of Tiffany's the jeweller's while her mother was shopping for a wedding ring. But in the novel, her story is fleshed out in much more detail. And actually, it's a hell of a lot darker. In the novel, her father, she's named Tiffany Case because Tiffany's father was so annoyed that she was not a boy that he gave her mother $1,000 and a powder case from Tiffany's and walked out. So she decided to call her Tiffany. And in the book, her mother becomes a madam. And Tiffany's an alcoholic because she'd been gang raped by a group of men and she's developed a hatred of men. So Bond meets her and she's in a very, very dark place, but she's turned her life around. And obviously by the end of the book, they become lovers. And actually in the book, she's the only Bond girl ever to then stay with Bond at the end of the book and go and live with him. So she ends the book living with him. But in the next book, From Russia with Love, she's left Bond. She's found him too difficult to live with. And she's left to marry an American military man. So back to the film. Obviously, Guy Hamilton knew that Jill St. John had been imposed on him. And Jill St. John was, you know, aware of this as well. And it was obviously just the strength of this guy, Sidney Korshak. But Hamilton, begrudgingly, at the end, you know, he admitted that she was great in the film, and she is fantastic in that film.
Yeah,
that opening scene with her and the wigs, you know, and they're going backwards forwards and that banter about the cuffs and the collars and all that sort of stuff is really good. She's fantastic in the film, I think. She knew the Broccolis already, so apparently she didn't have to screen test. She hadn't read the book either, but she felt real affinity with the character. She said, I rather thought of her as myself. I put a lot of myself into the character and I just loved the name. She was outside of the norm. She was many, many things. And I feel like I've had several lives. I really identified with Tiffany. So interestingly about Jill St. John, as I mentioned, she had a relationship with Sean Connery, apparently. Her and Lana Wood, Plenty O'Toole, apparently had relationships with Connery during the making of Diamonds Are Forever. Because it was a period when Connery had separated from Diane Cilento and they actually divorced.
Where's Lazenby?
1973. Well, she left Lazenby and then shacked up with Connery. So
she's recast her boyfriend the same as Bond. They did with Bond.
Yeah, exactly.
She hasn't got Roger on the list as well.
Wasn't on the list, no. No, Roger was married, wasn't he, by the time? Yeah. So they filmed in Vegas and then at Pinewood, and Jill St. John said that she really enjoyed her time in London. She recalls the stuntman Bob Simmons making kippers for the crew at breakfast. And she actually rented a place owned by Jacqueline Saltzman, Harry's wife. She said that the Broccolis were really gracious hosts and they would often dine together. But she called Harry a little bit of a grey-haired bulldog, although she did admit that he was a kind man also. So that's about it with Jill St. John. She attended Cubby's funeral. She's had quite a big career afterwards. She left Hollywood in 1972, moved to Aspen, Colorado. She's had a career as a TV culinary TV chef on Good Morning America, and had a column in USA Weekend magazine throughout the 80s writing about food. She has been... She appeared in Seinfeld.
Did she?
Yeah, in the Yada Yada episode in 1997. And she has been married four times to Neil Dublin, who was the heir to a linen fortune, a man called Lance Reventlow, who I think had something to do with racing. Then she was married to a singer called Jack Jones, and then she was married to Robert Wagner from 1990, and she's still married to Robert Wagner now. Yeah, that's it. Her and Robert Wagner appear in a lot of films and TV things together, Around the World in 80 Days. And yeah, they've appeared on stage together and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, that's basically it. That's Tiffany Case, as played by Jill St. John, my new favourite Bond girl.
I think I was thinking about when I think of Tiffany Case in Diamonds Are Forever, I do think, oh, she's great. And then I think about the film and I think, oh, the film's not that good. So she's probably one of the best features of that film. I seem to remember she does the same thing though that we mentioned quite a lot, where she does start off quite interesting and then she ends up being a little bit pathetic towards the end. And
well, they put her in that bikini in the end, don't they? She has that whole sequence on the oil rig and she's just basically wearing a bra and knickers, which happens quite a bit, doesn't it? But she's got a bit of sass to her, I think. She's quite an interesting character.
Yeah, I just reiterate that, really. I watched Diamonds Are Forever recently and yeah, she's definitely one of the positives. Yeah.
Well, I'm just glad they didn't go into as much depth as they did in the book with her. I think that would have changed the film quite a bit.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's it for another episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast. Thank you so much for listening to our ramblings on about the James Bond films. We will be back next time with another special.
Ooh.
Which one is it? I don't actually know.
Casino Royale.
Oh, blimey. Which one?
We're going to do in chronological order. So strap yourselves in. We're going off-piste. We're doing 1967's Casino Royale starring David Niven.
Ooh. Oh, boy.
Indeed.
Right, I haven't actually seen this. How am I going to get a copy?
Well, listen, we'll
it's
do it.
It's quite easy to get on. I think it's only about a fiver online to buy. Yeah.
So that's
going to probably make a lot of money out of people looking for Casino Royale, seeing that and looking at the blurb and going, oh, it's James Bond, that's the one, getting it, and then they realise it's Woody Allen.
Christmas ruined.
Yeah.
Well, it's
going to
be...
All the dads going, oh, brilliant.
It's going to be an interesting one for sure. So please join us next time and, while we delve into a Bond film that isn't really a Bond film, but still interesting nonetheless. But if people want to get in touch with us, how can they get hold of us?
On all the socials, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, with the handle @JamesBondA to Z. Z.
Or please...
Oh, said it again. Bond, what? It's got American again. Sorry, it's fine.
Did you say email just then?
No.
Oh, I'll say that now. or please do email us at... podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Yeah, and wherever you're listening to this, please leave us a good review. Tell your friends, tell your enemies.
Tell us if you like it or not.
Tell us if you like it or not. And please join us next time. James Bond will return. Not the actual James Bond, but a James Bond.
Thanks.
Ciao.
James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy, and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% Lean Ground Sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.